This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Flash flooding and severe storms have continued to batter the Driftless area for the last 10 years, and major floods like the one in August 2018 have taken a toll on some residents. A new project from the Driftless Writing Center called Stories from the Flood aims to record the experiences of those affected by flooding in the Coon Creek watershed and the Kickapoo River watershed, and to support healing through telling these stories and inform policymakers' response to future flood events. Joining us is the director of the project, Tamara Dean, from the Driftless Writing Center. Gil Hull, a licensed clinical social worker and a consultant for Project Recovery, which provides support services for area flood survivors. Judy Mixter, a Coon Valley resident who was affected by the August 2018 flood. And Julie Fraser, secretary of the Lafarge Methodist Church, who helped organize a donation center there after the flood, both of whom are participants of Stories from the Flood. Tamara, I wonder if you can start by explaining a little bit about, first, what the Driftless Writing Center is.
Sure. The Driftless Writing Center is a nonprofit organization, primarily with an educational mission. We offer writing workshops. We bring in authors from the region and around the nation to read and offer craft talks or workshops. And we also help youth writers with, for example, their college application essays. So we serve the whole range of community in writing. But we decided we wanted to do something around the floods after our experiences were that we were affected by the floods, but not as severely as some of our neighbors. So following the August 2018 floods, we went out and helped mop floors and carry people's refuse from their basement to dumpsters. But we thought that that wasn't quite enough. So we came up with the idea for Stories from the Flood.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about where that idea came from and if the group has ever done any other projects like this, oral history projects?
So the idea, again, came from us wanting to do something more, and we knew the research around storytelling and writing out our stories and how that helps us heal and move forward after a traumatic event. So originally we did conceive this as a writing project. We got a generous major grant from the Wisconsin Humanities Council, which helped us kickstart the project. And we had arranged to hold workshops at all the libraries in the Coon Creek and Kickapoo River watersheds. So we had a total of 26 workshops. Initially, as I said, we intended for people to write, and we would offer prompts and we would guide people. But it turned out that writing just wasn't everybody's thing, and most people preferred to speak to someone and to tell their story into a microphone. So that became an oral history project as opposed to a writing project. And the Driftless Writing Center has not undertaken an oral history project before, so we did need some training on how to go about it, training on best practices for gathering oral history and also archiving and creating transcripts and editing those. It's been a great learning opportunity, and it has been a much bigger project than the Writing Center has undertaken before.
I want to dig into this a little bit later in the show, but I wonder, Tamara, if you can just, now that you've collected some of these stories and have kind of the scope of this project laid out, kind of what do you hope this project accomplishes?
From the beginning, we wanted to help people heal and move forward. And I think that that has happened. It has happened individually, it's happened one-on-one, and it's happened in a group setting. For example, in our November 7th event, where we gathered storytellers and gathered people who had been interviewing the storytellers, including students from UW-Madison, who made this part of their Writing Rivers English class. That was one goal that we're continuing to pursue. Another goal has been to create this archive of stories around this historic event for posterity, for future researchers and historians. So that's still in the works. We aim to collect 200 stories. We have about 80 so far, and they will be archived at the Vernon County Historical Society, as well as the UW-La Crosse's Murphy Library. And then finally, we wanted from this project to create a change or have an influence on policy making. So this booklet that we came out with of quotes from all of the stories we've collected so far, called Stories from the Flood, A Reflection of Resilience, has been handed to this staff people at Representative Kine's office and Senator Schilling's office and Senator Baldwin's office. It's also gotten into the hands of DNR and DOT and Army Corps of Engineer personnel. So they have paid attention to the personal experiences, and we would like to keep bringing this to their attention so that we can translate personal experience into policy changes. And it could be anything from determining what zoning in a village does to land that floods often. I mean, our flood maps have changed with the 7 100-year floods of the last 11 years. And that planning could just be could be more resources for mental health services. It could be help for businesses to move to higher ground. But we just want to make sure that the personal is part of the conversation.
That's Tamara Dean, director of the Stories from the Flood Project by the Driftless Writing Center, here with us today to talk about how communities have been affected by major flooding in the Driftless area and how a new oral history project could help residents heal. She's joined by Judy Mixer of Coon Valley and Julie Frazier of Lafarge, both participants of the Stories from the Flood Project, and Gil Hull, a licensed clinical social worker. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Judy, I wonder if you can share why you wanted to participate in this Stories from the Flood project.
Well, I don't know if there's a why, but I think there was a need to communicate our story more than anything else. We probably experienced more damage than most in our community. And I also wanted people to know how thankful we were for the help and the response that we got from all areas in helping us recover.
Yeah, can you share, Judy, a little bit about how you guys were affected by the August 2018 flood, maybe taking us back to kind of what happened that night and kind of the aftermath?
Well, it was raining, obviously, and we noticed that our backyard was getting a little flooded. And towards about 10 or 11 o'clock at night, my husband heard some water in the basement. So he went down and checked, and he noticed that some water was seeping into our side wall. So, and our basement was finished. We had a bedroom down there. We had a little living area. We had my grandson's playroom. We had an office, storeroom, and a workroom, plus a full bathroom. He got the rugs up and lifted a few other things up for safety. We knew we were going to have a little bit of water in the basement, so we were prepared for that. There wasn't anything you could do about it. You just see what was going to happen the next morning. About 30 minutes later, so I went upstairs and got ready for bed, and I was laying in bed reading, and he came back and he said, "You got to come and see this." I said, "I just saw it." And he goes, "No, you got to come and see this." So we walked halfway down the basement stairs, and the two windows on the back side of our house had blown out, and we had geysers, that's all I can describe it, of mud and water just shooting in the back part of our basement. We couldn't try to save anything because the electricity was still on. So, and by that time we had about 6 inches of water down the basement and mud. So you didn't want to take a chance on going down there. So, and I went upstairs, got dressed, because we didn't know what was going to happen at that point. We went out the back on our deck, and we could see that the water was high enough to be level with our deck. So you don't know what you're going to do when stuff like this starts to happening, because you don't know where are you going to go. We went out the front door. We couldn't go anywhere because there was rapids on both sides of our house and in the front. So we were technically just locked in that house, and we didn't know what was going to happen. The water and the mud started coming in our sliding glass doors off our deck. So we were putting rugs, towels, anything we could grab up there to try to stop the water from coming in. And of course, then we went out on the front porch, and we had already been asked like a couple of hours prior to that by the fire and rescue if we were fine. And at that point, we were. You know, again, we knew we were going to have water in the basement, but we would deal with that. So I tried to go out on the porch to get somebody's attention that it became clear we were going to have to leave the house. And we were standing out on the porch figuring out how we were going to do that, because fire and rescue was then at a different part of the town. They were no longer in our neighborhood. And we heard this crash. And my husband said, "I think the back wall of our foundation caved in. And I said, "No, that's not possible. I thought my hutch had fallen over." And okay. And he goes, "No, it's the basement wall." And I said, the house started to shudder at that point. And the water was coming up through the hardwood floors and the carpeting. And we started to get about 6 inches in the main floor. So we got scared at that point. Grabbed our little dog, and I was at the end, the electricity was still on. So I was flicking the porch light, trying to get somebody's attention to come and get us. And across the street, kitty corner from us, a neighbor, her husband, is part of fire and rescue. So she kept calling him and saying, we're known as Grandma and Grandpa in the neighborhood. And she said, "You got to go get Grandma and Grandpa off the porch. Something happened to their house." So they came with a backhoe, and they got us off the front porch, and we were in the bucket of the backhoe, and they took us 2 blocks up to where the water was manageable, and then they took us in a police car to the school, which is where we stayed the rest of the night.
So. Can you explain the condition of your home after that? I mean, it sounds like there must have been extreme damage.
Well, yeah. The basement wall did cave in, and part of the side. Our house was hanging over nothing. We had busted windows. We had the siding on the back from the swoosh of the water and the mud coming up. It basically loosened all the back siding. We had, I can tell you, our air conditioner was just hanging by a cord. We had, the basement was still about 3/4 full of water. Everything down there was totally ruined. And it was amazing to me how when they started pulling stuff out of the basement, things weren't recognizable. The mud and everything that caved in basically just pulverized everything. There wasn't like you pull out a jar, or you pull out a glass, or you pull out a container or whatever. My dad's desk was down there, and it's just totally in pieces. It was totally unrecognizable. I will have to say that I called a friend of mine, and I asked if her husband, who works in construction, if he could come over and do something with the house, because I knew if we didn't do something, the house was going to cave in. And he came over and he said, no, he goes, there's no way I'm going down there. He goes, but I know who will, because we knew we had to get some support poles up to hold the house up. And sure enough, he went to his neighbor, who was an Amish gentleman, and Jeremiah came over to the house, and he goes, well, he goes, I can put, it looks like you need about 5 support poles, and I can put those up, but if my brother agrees to help me. Now, this is very dangerous for them, because the house was hanging, and that house could have caved in on them at any moment. But they went to Menards, they got 5 steel poles, and Jeremiah and his brother went down the basement and shored up our house.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. We're talking about Stories from the Flood, a project by the Driftless Writing Center to preserve the experiences of residents affected by the August 2018 flood and help communities heal. We're here with Judy Mixter of Coon Valley, who's sharing her story. Also with us is participant Julie Frazier of Lafarge, project director Tamara Dean from the Driftless Writing Center, and clinical social worker Gil Hull. Judy, and sharing your story for the Stories from the Flood project, one thing that really stood out to me was that you were very passionate, very adamant about wanting to stay in your home in Coon Valley and wanting to try to save your home. Can you talk about why that was?
Well, we've only been in the Coon Valley area for 3 years. My granddaughter lives kitty corner from us, and she had an opportunity to go to PA school, but she has a little boy, and her husband is a nurse at Mayo's and works odd shifts, so there was no way that she could go to PA school, which was in Dubuque, unless she had someone there that could take care of her little boy. And as make a long story short, and I can make a long story, let me tell you. We ended up buying a house kitty corner from her so that we could take care of her little boy, so she could go to PA school. And I retired and moved down here so we could do that. And we took all our resources and bought this house and remodeled it and updated it. And I knew that this was it. This was all we had. So I had to figure out a way to save it. And once the concrete company came and told me they could rebuild the back wall and save my house, then that's the path I took. We were going to save it, and we did.
Do you know people or know of other people in Coon Valley who have chosen to leave after the August 2018 flood?
Yeah, we had an elderly lady down the street that the front part of her foundation caved in a little bit too. She didn't experience as much devastation as we did, but her family said, you're not going to live there anymore, you're moving. So, and there's been a couple of other people that have left actually Coon Valley, but they're still in the area. Some people had to, a couple of families had to actually buy another house in Coon Valley because their house was condemned.
We have a few clips from other residents in this. I want to bring in Robert Owens now from Viola, who talked about a similar experience of seeing neighbors forced to leave. Let's listen to Robert.
And I know there's still many other people, many other families. There's families that were literally run out of town. They had to leave with children and whatnot, and they had to leave. And the businesses, our gas station, which I'm only one small house and then I'm the next one, the gas station was literally destroyed. And they're finally back up on, and just started back up this month. But they've been closed for 7 months. So even if you wanted to, if you could go down and wanted to buy food or whatnots, even gas, you couldn't do it. You had to leave town. So for us to get anything, we had to get to the next town, either Reedstown or Lafarge. Well, now we don't own a car. Neither one of us drive. Now you got to find a ride. Mm. Yeah, so that kind of, you know, it can definitely be stressful.
Gil, as a social worker who has, you know, helped people facing these types of situations that, you know, that Judy is describing, that we heard from Robert Owens and Viola, can you talk about those kind of immediate needs that you go to and when someone is in, kind of in the immediate aftermath of the flood?
Yeah, I think, it's important to understand that recovering from disasters really happens in phases. And, you know, what we generally see after major disasters, certainly there's the impact that affects individuals and communities. And then there's sort of the heroic phase that I think a lot of us witness, that where people come in and they support, and it can feel as though people, particularly who have been impacted, they get the support they need right away. That can lead them into a period of feeling almost like there's a honeymoon until the reality of some of these situations set in. I mean, we're, you know, talking about the story of someone who's moved there recently, put all their resources into it. There's the immediate trauma of just making sure that we're okay and the immediate support that comes. But then there's the long-term, what are we going to do and where are we going to find solutions? And you know, one of the things that I'm aware of is that there's all sorts of resources that come in from the outside because local communities do not have the resources to respond. So really what you're looking at is individual trauma and then collective trauma. And what we've seen up and down some of these rivers in the Kickapoo River Valley is these communities have been hit time and time again, and the social fabric of those communities has been torn. In normal, I would say normal recoveries, there's an event and there's a year period where things start to come together. But what we've seen more and more in our river valleys is there's the event, people start to recover, and then there's another event. People start to recover, and then there's another event. And this is adding to the stress and strain of some of these smaller communities.
Yeah, Gil, I wonder if there are added challenges because many of the communities in the Driftless area that we're talking about, communities like Coon Valley, like Lafarge, I mean, these are small towns, right? They're small towns, and I just wonder if there is an added strain there.
I think there is an added strain, but I think one of the beauties of doing, now, I guess what we talk about a little bit in my field is disaster mental health. You know, one of the things that's happening all the time, whether people know it or not, is people are taking care of one another's mental health without calling it that. And so what we've learned with the stress and strain of these communities that continue to get hit is there are a lot of interventions that can occur to keep lifting up these communities and can keep sort of reweaving this social fabric that continues to get torn. And I think the Writing Project is a perfect example of how people come together and start sharing their stories. That pulls them out of feeling isolated, I'm the only one. They begin to recognize, well, we are a social group, we are connected. They hear a story from someone and they recognize, I've got that same story. Suddenly, you know, you begin to see the social fabric start to get rewoven, even with the ongoing challenges of these small communities that have been hit for years with the disaster of the farming, the fallen farming, and from that point forward, they are communities that are sort of drying up. No pun intended, because they're really not drying up.
Tamara, have you seen some of those connections among neighbors, among fellow community members, made through sharing these stories and the stories from the Flood Project?
Yes, I think so. One thing that has surprised us from listening to the stories is the common concerns and sharing those with each other, I think, has been helpful. For instance, I think at our event in November, when a bunch of storytellers came together, and then also through this booklet, as people are reading it, they recognize that, oh, I'm not the only one who gets very nervous when it rains. This has been a lingering trigger for people. And I see people in the room nodding their heads, Judy and Julie, and I too am, you know, a little more nervous when we get some of those heavy rains. And somebody, Gwen Sieverhuis, who is featured in our booklet, said that if it rains more than an hour and a half, she just leaves. She drives away from her home. So I think that some people were surprised, as we were, to find that, oh, we're all kind of thinking this. We're all in this together. But the fact that we have this booklet with the quotes from the interviews has really made it a tangible sharing, if you will. And I think it's been touching for people who have gone through this to see what people an hour away, you know, because this was a broad swath of flooding, that people an hour away are still dealing with the same kind of trauma.
Tamara Dean, director of the Stories from the Flood Project by the Driftless Writing Center, is here with us today to talk about how flooding in August 2018 affected communities across the Driftless area, and how the new project, Stories from the Flood, could help communities heal. She's joined by Gil Hull, a licensed clinical social worker, and participants of Stories from the Flood, Judy Mixter of Coon Valley and Julie Frazier of Lafarge. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation on Stories from the Flood and hear how the project can inspire change among local officials and lawmakers. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking about a new project by the Driftless Writing Center called Stories from the Flood. The oral history project is aimed at preserving the experiences of residents affected by flooding in the Kickapoo River and Coon Creek watersheds in August 2018. The group hopes the project will promote healing and inspire local lawmakers and officials to help communities be more resilient to future flooding. Joining us is the project director, Tamara Dean, Gil Hull, a licensed clinical social worker and consultant for Project Recovery, which provides support services for area flood survivors, Judy Mixter, a Coon Valley resident who was affected by the August 2018 flood, and Julie Frazier, secretary of the Lafarge Methodist Church, who helped organize a donation center there after the flood. Julie, I want to turn to you and hear a little bit about your experience during the August 2018 flood. So maybe take us back to that night and kind of what led you to create this donation center there.
Well, basically, it started to rain on my birthday. So that was my concern, is the kids are like, well, are you going to make it home, Mom? And I'm like, yeah, I'll be home. And then I got a call from one of our families in the church, and they were in Viola, where they live, and their basement wall was collapsing too, and there was big gaps in the cement and everything. So got in our trucks and went over there, realizing the house was very unstable, so we started hauling everything we could out of the house to save what we could. In the meantime, not realizing it, but the church was flooding too. The river water and mud had came up and was going in through the lower level. But that was not, you know, our major concern at the time. So once we got one of our members as much stuff out of the house as we could, and as I was kind of driving, I noticed everybody throwing everything out, and it just kind of broke my heart. And I said, these people have nothing. And I was hearing about how many people were homeless at that point. My phone was going nuts. And so I just decided, you know what? There is a need here, and everybody needs pretty much everything. And since the basement or the lower level of the church was had about 6 inches of the river water and the mud in there, we did have two gentlemen from our church that just happened to go check, and he was actually one that was working on the last flooding of the church. And he brought his generator, and they got most of the mud out as fast as they could. And I said, well, I'll worry about the cleaning of it later. And so couldn't really want people downstairs because you didn't want the mold, you didn't want any of that. So I turned the whole sanctuary and the fellowship hall and everything into a donation center. So every pew was full of anything. It could have been used, it could have been new items, it didn't matter. The food pantry in Lafarge was hit hard. So they brought some of their food that they could salvage, and we started putting that in the church for anybody. And then basically it just grew and grew and grew. So Sunday morning or Saturday night, my sons and I would take the stuff off the pews and try to get them underneath the pews so that we could at least have church service in the morning. And then as soon as church was done, we lifted everything back up all into the pews. I stayed open 7 days a week, pretty much 15, 20 hours a day, for at least 6 to 7 weeks. And at that point, school was back in session. I had kids that needed a routine again. So at that point, all of our donations ended up going to Viroqua. But just the people I got to meet, and donations came from all over. Like, I think I had 4 different states bringing stuff. And that was amazing. And then we had people that were hit from all over coming. And I had people showing up with no shoes on because that mud was horrible and it stunk and it destroyed everything. So people would be coming in and trying to put shoes on. I had a gentleman that came in every day for enough food for the day. A lot of these people were living in hotels, tents, wherever they could find a place to stay. And after talking, you know, some people wanted to talk, some people just wanted to cry, some people just wanted to sit, and you sat with them, you prayed with them, you did whatever they needed from you. One of our hottest items was actually a can opener, because everybody that was staying, most of those cans of food you get required a can opener. So when we started advertising, we needed some foods with, like, pull tabs on them. A lot of our families got very excited because they could actually have something besides bread and peanut butter. And as soon as we ran out of something, the next car that pulled up with a donation had exactly what we ran out of. It was like a miracle. There was no explanation for it. And it happened over and over and over. But just watching these people have a little hope when they walked back out was wonderful. And I mean, the donations we got in was just amazing. I wish I would have brought some pictures, but we are a pretty good sized sanctuary, and we were full, and we had storage in the back, and people would fill up their vehicles as much of stuff as they could. And we had people that didn't have a lot to donate, but they went through like their Civil War drawers. Anything that they had little extras of, they brought in. So, I mean, it was a whole communities coming together, which was nice.
Yeah, that was something that stuck out from your story for this project, Stories from the Flood, was just the way that you got to see the Lafarge community come together. Can you talk a little bit more about that feeling of unity? And I wonder if it's still there now that we're more than a year out since the August 2018 flood.
I've only been in the Lafarge Church for 5 years. So I was kind of an outsider. I'm actually from Biola area. So a little bit of an outsider, not much, but a little bit. And it was amazing. I worked with the other church too, with Pastor Mark, and some of our other people went around house to house to see exactly what some people might have needed, because some wouldn't have been able to get over to the church right away. But it was just amazing to watch groups of people come in. Even schools brought in their football teams or their volleyball teams or whatever to come help and clean out houses. I was very, very impressed with Lafarge at how well they did. Their fire department, their emergency workers, just everybody worked together. You didn't hear complaints. Lafarge lost electricity for 3 days. So everybody at that point, you know, freezers was an issue. One of the restaurants outside of town brought in food and they served it right off Main Street for whoever needed meals to eat. People brought in their campers so people had a place to stay. It was amazing. And as I, once in a while, would get to drive around a little bit to different areas, I was really amazed at how much Lafarge had really worked together and made sure everybody was taken care of. I still think they're very close now. You still get the thank yous. You still be walking somewhere and they're like, oh, do you remember me? And of course I'll say I do. But these people knew that they had some hope at that point. And that's all you want to do is, you know, make sure everybody's got something to look forward to. And that's hard during those situations.
Gil, in the aftermath of flooding events like this, you know, how often is it, you know, faith organizations like churches stepping in to kind of help fill the void? I mean, is there a need in this area to make sure that these communities are getting the services, whether it's donations of can openers or mental health services?
Well, I think there's a misunderstanding sometimes when a disaster strikes that people, the first word that goes out is FEMA, you know, a federal emergency management agency is going to come in and they're going to help us restore things. The truth of the matter is FEMA comes in and it's a jump start. That's just the beginning. Really, it's the volunteer organizations active in disaster, which are faith-based organizations. All of the different resources that come together, VOAD is the acronym for it, those are the folks that are going to carry a individuals and communities back to at least helping them restore to pre-disaster levels. So I think that those organizations are vital because they're there for the long term. And I know in our area what they formed were VOAD groups, unmet need committees, that are still operating, actually. In our particular region, there's an unmet need committee that's continuing to look at unmet needs. But not only that, they're trying to get established so they'll be ready for the next disaster, because there will undoubtedly be something that will come along that will require something beyond what we're used to doing on a daily basis.
That's Gil Hull, a licensed clinical social worker, here with us today to talk about how communities have been affected by major flooding in the Driftless area and how a new project called Stories from the Flood could help residents heal. He's joined by Julie Frazier and Judy Mixter, both participants of Stories from the Flood, and Tamara Dean, project director. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Gil, I wonder if you can speak more about kind of the outstanding needs that people still have, even though we're over a year since the August 2018 floods.
Well, I live up by Ontario, so I'm more familiar with my local community in terms of the unmet needs. I think one of the dilemmas that continues to exist is that people who have been displaced, and that would include a number of businesses in this small village, They're still waiting for final word in terms of buyouts and things of that nature. So they've been on hold literally for over a year, and that's been probably some of the most stressful types of things. I think, by and large, a lot of the folks who were displaced have found places to live, but they've lost their homes. So those things that may have meant so much to them, they may have places to live, but they still are struggling with grief and loss. In my experience, moving from grief to a place of mourning becomes a big, big difference. When we mourn something, we've found something to stand on and honor the loss, and we're able to move forward. If we're stuck in grief, that can continue to go on for years. So there has to be ways to, I think the stories from the floods, it's a way that people come together to begin to move from grieving to mourning. where they are able to understand, you know, I am recovering, I'm doing better than I was at the beginning. There's a long way to still go, but I'm connected, which is vital. I think people only recover through being connected. Trauma tends to make us isolate. Trauma is something we try to suppress and push down. I think stories are a way that we begin to get trauma out in the open and begin to understand that we all share this trauma. It's not just our own individual trauma.
Yeah, Tamara brought up an example of the kind of lingering trauma, something very simple, fear of it raining. And we actually have a story on this from another resident of the Driftless area who contributed to the Stories from the Flood project. That's Monica Sanchez from Wilton.
The other day, I work in, and our neighbor started to rain, and our neighbor put a video on Facebook. Oh my gosh, look at how fast go the water go up. And I feel like, I don't know, I tell my boss, you know what, I have to go, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really bad feel, you know, because I work far away, and just because I think my kids is in home, and what happened if I'm not really fast over there, you know? Or what happened if I can't cross because the river is in another road is bad or something like that?
Judy, as someone who has, lived through this August 2018 flood that Monica Sanchez is talking about, I wonder if there is a little uncertainty, anxiety still there with the potential of more flooding.
Oh, there's a lot of anxiety. I have the rain anxiety as well. And I think also there's triggers that... when you have a loss and you've lost everything, and an example is Christmas. All my Christmas decorations that I've collected for years were down the basement, as well as my Christmas tree. So it comes Christmas, and last year, you know, we had someone else's Christmas tree, someone else's decorations. I didn't have any of mine. And this year, we're back in our house. And I have no tree, I have no decorations. All the things that the kids made me throughout the years are all gone. Things my grandmother made are gone. So there's those types of triggers that, the other day I made a pie and it was like, I had pie left over and, I had a pie carrier. A pie carrier. It was down the basement. So throughout the whole year, whether it's raining or not, you have those little triggers that bring it all back to you.
Julie, I wonder from your experience helping to run this donation center, helping people access things, if there was a mourning that Gil was talking about earlier of things that people lost.
Christmas was a big thing. I remember that. And as Christmas happened last year, we kind of did put a little request out that some people were missing that. Family pictures, you know, a lot of people just store their pictures. That was a big thing that people talked about. Things that they just can't get back, you know, is things that were donated or inherited from their families, that they know they just can't get. And as much as I would have loved to have been able to find them, those things, I just couldn't. So, you know, but, you know, like somebody, you know, when they didn't even have shoes, they didn't have blankets, you know, we'll figure it out, you know, but we're not going to give up on them either.
Tamara, in sharing all of these really powerful stories from the August 2018 floods, you mentioned that, you know, your hope is that when people read these, listen to these, that they, won't feel so alone, you know, that they'll find that kind of connection. I wonder if you can talk about how people can access some of these stories that you guys are collecting.
The stories from the flood booklet that we published at the same time that we had our event in November, we've gone through our first printing because it's been so popular, but there are copies at libraries throughout the Coon Creek and Kickapoo River watershed. So everywhere from Coon Valley all the way down to Gays Mills, the libraries have a few copies of those. The Vernon County Historical Society has a copy of those. So that in the short term, people can access the quotes from some of those stories. In the long term, we do intend to have these stories archived and publicly accessible, as I said, at the Vernon County Historical Society and at the UW-La Crosse Murphy Library. Most of them are in audio form. We did have a few people who wrote their stories, and we also have a few videotaped stories, but a lot of people didn't want to be videotaped. This complete collection, besides being at those archives, I think that some of the libraries are going to have sort of summaries of some of the stories in written forms and in binders at the libraries, the stories that apply to their villages. So in that sense, people can ultimately access them through the libraries. And I should say that the librarians have been terrific partners in this project, as has been the Vernon County Historical Society and the UW-Madison class, which has come out to help interview people who survived the floods. And I think that's been a particularly great example of building community across generations and across location. Some of the students who have come out to interview have said that this project was life-changing for them because they just didn't realize how a natural disaster affected people. They had never been through one. Some of them had never even heard of the flooding. And they've since done projects from what they've learned in the stories, including a mental health brochure and a physical health brochure, helping people understand what to do in the aftermath of a flood, because besides mental health, physical health was dramatically affected by this flood, whether it was people with intestinal illnesses after being in flood water or mold and respiratory problems. And this continued for 6 or 7 months, you know, after the flood. So that's a long-winded answer to your question.
I believe you said you've collected 80 stories so far. What is your story? Do you have a goal of how many stories you'd like to collect, or a time frame of when you'll continue to collect stories?
We originally had a goal of 200 stories, and I believe that we will reach that next year. It was a little slow going in the beginning, but the more people saw their neighbors contributing and, you know, people from their churches or their schools contributing, the more they wanted to step up and add their story. We've also had a lot of cases of people saying, well, my story was not that interesting. You should talk to, you know, the neighbors. They had a much more interesting story. But I think that's partly typical Midwestern humility. And so we've found those people and encourage them because they really do have valuable stories.
As we briefly wrap up here, you mentioned earlier that you've sent this out to lawmakers, officials in state and federal agencies. How do you hope this inspires change on that level?
I hope that it causes lawmakers and policymakers to pause as they're drafting new policies, whether they have to do with planning or allocating resources, money or other resources, and consider these individual experiences and understand that the people who are most deeply affected are often the people who have the least political power. They might be poor, or they might just not be able to navigate that system, not have the access or understanding. So I hope that these stories keep those personal experiences in the lawmakers' minds as they decide how we move forward.
Tamara Dean is Project Director of Stories from the Flood. She's joined by project participants Julie Frazier from Lafarge and Judy Mixter from Coon Valley, along with Gil Hull, a licensed clinical social worker. They joined us today to talk about how local communities are healing from the August 2018 floods and how the Stories from the Flood project will help communities be more resilient to future floods.
And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Our show is produced by Senior News Editor and Producer John Davis. If you missed part of today's program, you can find the audio archives at WPR.org/newsmakers. Our site has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at WPR.org/newsmakers.